Going? We doing okay? Yeah? It's good to be together, yes? Yes. I agree. Walter Brueggemann, he's an Old Testament scholar. Some of you have probably read him. I'm going to mention him a couple times tonight. But he says, when you and I approach the Psalms, it's helpful to think about them sometimes in three rough categories. He says we can divide them into three broad types. You might think about them in terms of three modes of discourse or three lanes on a highway or whatever is helpful to you. But he says we have psalms of orientation. That's the first group. These are the psalms that evoke this sense of gratitude or praise to God for who God is, for his character and his blessing and his care for us day in and day out, the way God is always watching over us. You have the psalms of orientation. And by the way, you might remember these categories if you were around a few years ago. We did a series on the Psalms and talked about these ideas. The Psalms of orientation. And then secondly, Brueggemann says we have the Psalms of disorientation, which is when we talk badly about that first group of Psalms, right? No. We have the Psalms of disorientation, which give voice to our suffering, our anguish, our frustration, our fear, our confusion, our despair. These are the dark Psalms. These are the ones that we go to when it's a bad week. It's been a bad week, maybe a bad year. We go to the Psalms of disorientation, right? And then he says the third group are Psalms of new orientation, which is like the one that we're looking at tonight, Psalm 107. And these are the ones that capture moments when new life breaks in unexpectedly. Somehow, when a person or a group of people wake up again to the surprise, the miracle of grace in their lives, get caught off guard again by grace. I was fishing through my files this week because there was a poem I'd written down a long time ago that dramatizes this move toward new orientation. It's a poem by Frank O'Hara. It says this: when I was a child, I played by myself in a corner of the schoolyard, all alone. I hated dolls and I hated games. Animals were not friendly and birds flew away. You hear the alienation so far? It's a cheery poem, isn't it? It gets better. If anyone was looking for me, I hid behind a tree and cried out, I am an orphan. Oh, good. It's interesting, actually. I like the way that he ends each of these stanzas, you may notice, with two words, one small phrase, two words, all alone, flew away, an orphan, right? And now we're going to get the turn. And here I am, the speaker says, the center of all beauty, writing these poems. Imagine. I was just struck by that several years ago. I think I was in a doctor's office or something, found it in a magazine, scribbled it out. What I liked about the poem was that the speaker is saying, you know, once upon a time, things were really bleak. Things were really dark for me. I was alone. I was a forgotten person. I didn't have much hope for my life. I didn't have much vision for the future. No one was looking out for me. And then somehow something intervened between then and now, between the past and the present. A whole host of circumstances conspired to bring me to this place. And now here I am in the present moment, and my life is completely different. It's like I've found a vocation. I've found something that I love to do and that I'm good at, and I've found my voice. And it's even like some of the darkness in my past, as I do this work of writing poetry, it's like the darkness in my past is being reconstituted and changed into beauty. Imagine. That's the voice of new orientation. And that's the voice of Psalm 107. There were these people, the psalmist says, who were in trouble. They thought they were alone. They thought they were lost. Actually, they knew for a fact that they were lost. Utterly lost, and yet to their great surprise and delight, they discovered that they weren't lost to God. And instead of living the rest of their days in exile and fear and frustration and anger and despair, God ended up gathering these people together, some of them over days, some of them over years. God began to gather them to himself from the east, west, north, and south. Imagine that. You see, the poem and the psalm are doing essentially the same thing. One commentator calls it memory as an act of futurity. In other words, as an act of looking forward, a way of looking ahead. It's when we draw together what has happened to us over the last year, say, and what's happened to us yesterday, and then we allow new possibilities to open up for us, and we begin to anticipate what tomorrow might bring. Because that's what happens sometimes, have you noticed, when you stop and actually like consider where you've come from and all the things that God has brought you to, brought you through, and all the stuff that has led you up to this present moment, don't you sometimes get in this place where you think, wow, what might God be capable of next? In the next year, in the next 10 years of my life. You know what I'm talking about? The psalmist is trying to train the people of God, the memory of the people of God, to make that move. Or you could say it like this: the psalmist is trying to teach you and me how to value our stories, how to honor the story that God is telling in our life right now, the story in all of its messiness and all of its difficulty and pain and all of its beauty. Trying to teach us to honor those stories and to honor the God who is a part of those stories. What kind of a God are we dealing with? The psalmist says we're dealing with a God who enters in to the lives of regular people like us. We're dealing with a God who goes before. We're dealing with a God who comes alongside to rescue and to comfort and to correct when necessary and to heal when necessary and to lead and to love. We're talking about a God whose orientation, whose posture toward people like us is that word Tim talked about a few weeks ago, hesed. It's the idea of this long arc of fidelity, this long arc of compassion toward human beings. That's the kind of God that we're dealing with, the psalmist says. Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, verse 1. His hesed endures. One translation puts it, confess Yahweh. Confess Yahweh, for he is good. His commitment is forever. Do you need help remembering tonight that you and I are living lives, the overarching motif of which is God's commitment to us, God's mercy toward us? I don't know about you, but sometimes when I think about my life and I think about God's presence and God's activity in my life, I start to get really short-sighted at times, and it's really easy for me to stop believing that God's actually involved at all and that the Spirit is in any respect hovering over the chaos. You know what I'm talking about? Sometimes, you know, we get to this place, I think, where the disorientation of our lives is so present, the frustration, the difficulty, the pain of our lives is so present, so in our face that it's all we can see. Right? And we find ourselves going, there's no way God is a part of this. How could God be a part of this? This doesn't even make sense. This isn't supposed to happen like this. And by the way, I think it's important to bear witness to those kinds of experiences. We'll talk more about that. That's what the Psalms of Disorientation are about. And then I think other times maybe the problem isn't so much that our lives are particularly difficult, it's just that our lives are so mundane. You know what I'm saying? Like, just totally undramatic, commonplace, and it's hard when you look around and you just, you know, see the monotony and the repetition of your life, and you're just going from one day to the next. It's hard to believe that God is somehow in the mix, right? And then you hear a story, you know, someone tells this story about some borderline miraculous thing that God has done for them and rescued them from this crisis or that crisis, and you start thinking, well, God must really like him. She must be important to God. You know, for me, if I get it in my head that God has kind of stopped paying attention to me, it's almost like it becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy, I've noticed. Because even though I'm being carried, I'm still being upheld or attended to from one day to the next, even though I'm still being surrounded by all kinds of gifts, even though God's blessing and love is still flowing toward me through other people, through the circumstances of my life, it's like I can't even see it anymore because I've stopped looking. And I hear a story like that, you know, something happening to somebody and it's kind of dramatic and kind of impressive, and I start thinking, why is it that that sort of thing never happens to me? That never happens to me. To which Psalm 107 says, due respect, really? Really? Seriously? Maybe that doesn't ever happen to you, the psalmist says. Maybe that's true, or maybe you need a new orientation. Because, you know, we're dealing with a God. This God thinks about everybody. This God pays attention to everybody. This God loves everybody. This God pursues everybody. Psalm 40 in the New Living Translation, there's this verse that says, "As for me, I am poor and needy, but the Lord is thinking about me right now." Isn't that good? Talk about a new orientation turn. As for me, I am poor and needy, but someone's thinking about me. And the psalmists say, that's the kind of God that we're talking about. This God doesn't care about hierarchy. This God does not get enamored with people's profile, you know? This God isn't feeding the important people stories so they can tell the less important people. That really hurt. God isn't feeding the important people stories so we can tell the less important people, you know, whatever. So we can tell them that we're more important, right? So that they can tell us that they're more important, however we would say that. And I think sometimes God says to me, you know, here's the thing. The only difference between you and that person over there, it's not that I'm not paying attention to the both of you, it's just that that person is paying attention to me. That person is paying attention to the gifts that I'm giving them, the way that I'm coming through for them. That's the only real difference between you. Here's what I love about Psalm 107. Instead of coming out and just accusing me of my short-sightedness or accusing us of our short-sightedness, the psalmist does something kind of interesting, in my opinion, even a little bit clever. Instead of just diagnosing our problem, the psalmist says, you know, I know some people who God's really been taking care of. I'm friends with some people that God has been very, very faithful to over the course of their lives. And then the psalmist begins to roll out these four representative experiences as a way of kind of asking us the question, has something like this ever happened to you? Psalmist says, I know some people who were wandering. You know, they were aimless and homeless, and they weren't even sure what they were looking for, and they were thinking, I'm not important, I'm small, I'm irrelevant, God doesn't pay attention to me. They were kind of like Hagar in the Old Testament in the book of Genesis. You know, Hagar, the slave girl of Sarah, of Abraham and Sarah, right? She gets sent away by Sarah into the desert. And she just has to fend for herself. She's a single parent. She's wandering around with no place to go, and no one's looking out for her, and she has no vision for where her life is headed. She doesn't even know if she's going to be able to survive. And then God sends an angel to come and find her in the desert. And the angel, when the angel arrives, the angel says to Hagar, where are you coming from, and where are you going? That's the angel's question, which if you think about it, seems like almost cruel in some respect, because that's the very question that someone like Hagar, who's a wanderer, can't answer. At least not in its fullness, right? Because you can't give a full answer to that question. Where are you coming from and where are you going? And Hagar says, well, I can tell you where I've come from. I'm running away. That's where I've come from. And as far as where I'm going, your guess is as good as mine. I have no idea. And the angel says, well, check it out. Just as God had a story for Abraham and Sarah, God has a story for you too. And it's going to take a little while before you start to see it. But the theme, the motif of that story is mercy, the hesed of God. That's what the story is going to be about when God is finished with you. And then I love this moment in that story. I'd encourage you to go read it. It's one of my favorite moments in the Old Testament. Hagar gives God a name, it says, which is a little bit of a scandalous thing to do for a woman of her class at that point, right? Hagar isn't a prophet. Hagar isn't a priest. She has no business giving God a name in this instance. God already has plenty of names, so just go ahead and use one of those, Hagar. You can take your pick if you want. But there's like a whole list here, right? No, she goes ahead and gives God a name based on her experience with the way God has come through for her. In the Hebrew, it's E-L-R-O-I, El-Rui. In the English, the God who sees me. You are the God who sees me, she says. I know some people like that, the psalmist says. You know, they thought they were alone. They thought they were just lost and no one was paying attention to them. And instead they discovered, or they were discovered by, a God who sees. So let those people give thanks for God's mercy and the wonders that he does for his children. And I have some other friends who were sitting in darkness. You know, they wished that they were out wandering around. They would have liked to have had that option, but they were stuck. They were confined by their circumstances. It's like every day was the same thing. They felt trapped. The horizon of their life was just very diminished and limited. And so they cried out to God, and they just said, God, I'm just suffocating over here. My life is claustrophobic. I need you to help me break out, find some relief. And God came alongside them and led them out of the darkness. And it's like he led them out into this place where they could see the sky again, where they could breathe again. I know some people who thought all of their good days were behind them, the psalmist says, and instead they discovered a God who took their little story and made it a part of his bigger story called Hesed, mercy. Let them give thanks. And I have some other friends, you know, they were fools. That's the third group. I have some friends who are just idiots, the psalmist says, you know. Don't you? I mean, we all do, right? And they make some decisions, or they made some decisions a while back that, you know, they knew it was a bad decision when they did it. It started leading them down this path, but they didn't really care because they don't like to think about things, you know, long term. They just want to live from day to day. And so they just kept barreling down this path, and it finally reached this dead end. And they knew they were in trouble, and they knew it was their fault. And they finally got desperate enough to turn to God and to ask for help, even though they were pretty sure God had written them off a long time ago, with good reason that God had written them off a long time ago. But they turned to God and they asked for help. And instead of finding a God who, you know, would shame them back into relationship, they found a God who doesn't treat us as our mistakes deserve. And he took that little story, even of their rebellion and their hard-heartedness, and built it into the larger story about mercy. And I don't mean to belabor the point, you know, the psalmist says, I just have a lot of groups of friends, you know, and I'll tell you about this last group. I have a lot of friends who are in over their heads, or were in over their heads at one point, and they pursued these various opportunities, this career, this particular project. They got married, they had kids, they got a mortgage, and all of a sudden, you know, they thought they were competent and clever, and they thought they were going to be able to handle everything they got involved in, but they found themselves at a place where they couldn't handle it, and they were pretty overwhelmed, and they didn't know what to do, and they were thinking to themselves, why did I even get myself in this mess? What was I thinking? And they almost quit, you know? They almost quit on that one relationship. They almost quit on their life. They almost just took off, made a mess of things. And they cried out to God. And God came alongside them. And even though they were stubborn and it took them a little while to admit defeat, God came alongside them anyway and entered into the chaos. And in time, they began to stabilize. God began to put their feet on a straight path. Didn't happen overnight, but it's happening, the psalmist says. Let those people give thanks to the Lord, for his mercy endures. And one of the things the psalmist is pointing out here is this. He's saying, here's what I've come to realize, that disaster befalls everybody, right? Disaster comes upon everyone. Some of us suffer, and some of us are confined, and some of us get sick, and some of us end up broke or hurt or confused or angry. Disaster befalls everybody. But what I've started to notice, the psalmist says, because of who God is that Hesed happens to everybody too. And just when we think that the mercy of God is exhausted in our lives, has run out, it makes a comeback. And so, verse 43, the last verse of the psalm, says, so whoever is wise will ponder these things and consider well the mercies of the Lord. Whoever's wise will consider God's mercy to them. And what might that mean for you and me tonight? Well, here's where we get back to Brueggemann. He says, here's the thing about the people of God as we see ourselves in the Psalms, because our lives aren't static. We're always moving from one phase of life to the next, and we're always in one transition of one sort or another. He says, what we see in the Psalms is that we're always making one of two moves. He calls them the decisive moves of faith. He says that we're either making a move from orientation to disorientation, or we're making a move from disorientation to new orientation. He says, here's what's interesting. Each of those moves we resist for different reasons. The first is the move from orientation, from just our regular kind of status quo existence, into disorientation. Brueggemann says that move is often a really hard one for some of us to make because we've had complaint or lament trained out of us. He says, you know, some of us have grown up in these environments, home environments, church environments, where we've been taught how to be tough, we've been taught how to be resilient, we've been taught how to be polite, we've been taught how to put a happy face on when things are difficult for us, but what we've lost in the process is the ability to tell the truth when things get really hard for us, the ability to stand before God in all candor and to just say, this is the reality of my life right now. It's not working. I need help. God, I hate this. God, where are you? Because I don't see any evidence of you right now. And he says, sometimes we resist that move because we're afraid of how God might respond to us in our weakness. Sometimes we resist making that move because we're afraid that other people around us are going to judge us for our lack of faith. And so instead, we suppress, we minimize, we relativize, we downplay our hurt and our confusion and our pain. And we end up breaking relationship with God as a result. And he says, if you and I are going to live honestly before God, an honest relationship with God, and an honest relationship with one another, then we're going to have to learn how to make this move again. And it is a move of faith. Why? Because when we decide to speak up and to tell the truth in God's presence, we are putting our trust in the idea that God prefers vulnerable people, that God prefers honest friendship over polite company. So it's a move of faith that God invites us to make, orientation to disorientation. And maybe that's the move for you tonight. You know, maybe that's what God is inviting you to do, to get really honest and to meet him in the middle of your pain. But there's a second move. And just as we resist the move into disorientation, Brueggemann says, we also strangely resist the move out of disorientation, which is weird. If you think about it, right? You would think that we would welcome the move out of disorientation, yeah? But we resist. We hold ourselves back, you know? Maybe we hold ourselves back because we're afraid that if we celebrate prematurely, life is going to come along and sucker punch us somehow. Maybe we hold ourselves back because even though we've sensed that God is rescuing us in this area, or as God is providing for us in this area, there's still a whole other part of our life that is unresolved, or there's questions that are open, and we're just waiting for everything to get worked out and finalized before we allow ourselves to make this move. Maybe we resist the move because we've just become desensitized to God's kindness. We have amnesia when it comes to God's kindness. Whatever the reason, Brueggemann says, we get stuck. And yet the message of Psalm 107 is this, that just as we must be willing to make this transition into disorientation, to be honest when we're in pain, we also have to become available as the people of God. We have to be available to make the move into gratitude and worship and praise when the time is right. We have to be available to come before God and say, okay, God, even though that situation is not resolved in my life, even though I still have some open questions, even though I still have some desires that have been unmet, even though I'm still a little bit confused about that one thing over there, the reality is that you keep taking care of me day in and day out. You've been taking care of me all the way up till now. Throughout my history, you're taking care of me today in the present moment, and you're going to take care of me well into the future. Your mercy is going to follow me every day of my life. So praise you. And here's what I saw in the last 24 hours as I was thinking about this psalm. This is new information for me, but it's cool. This psalm isn't primarily out to instruct you and I on how to live in relationship with God. The psalmist isn't out to teach. The psalmist isn't out to encourage. The psalmist isn't even out to provoke, ultimately. You know what the psalmist is out to do? The psalmist is praying for you and I that we would have the faith to make that second move. Let all those who the Lord has redeemed proclaim that he redeemed them. Let them give thanks to the Lord for his mercy. Let them remember, the psalmist says, that though they are feeling lost today, they aren't lost to God. Not yesterday, not today, not ever. Let them remember that they aren't alone. Let them see that whatever crisis has caught them off guard, that the hesed of God, the mercy of God endures. And then let them respond, God has done this for me. God has put my feet on a straight path. God led me out of darkness. God forgave me my many, many mistakes. God has put friends around me, has put me in community with people who love me. I was in over my head. I was in trouble, and God gave me what I needed to get through. And now God has brought me over many miles and many years to this place. Imagine that. Can you make this move tonight? Is God inviting you to make this move from disorientation or from whatever mode of existence you woke up in this morning to praise? I'll close with this. I was in Corpus Christi, Texas a couple months ago, six weeks ago, sometime a while back. I was in Corpus 8 weeks ago, two months. It was about there, spring break. But Corpus is where I grew up. It's the town of my boyhood. And so I had gone back to just kind of see how it was doing. And I was driving around my old neighborhood, and there was this bar that was about four blocks from where I grew up. And I'd never gone into it when I was a kid for obvious reasons. And I saw it as I was driving past, and I thought, well, you know, I'm an adult now, so I'm going to go see what this place is about. And walked in and got a beer and went and sat on the back porch and was just hanging out, minding my own business, reading. And this guy comes out, introduces himself. He says, I'm James. He says, you aren't from around here, are you? I'm like, no, used to be. He's like, you mind if I join you for a second? I'm like, sure. And this guy, he got a picture. I mean, he's like the salt of the earth, you know. He's got this big, bushy, gray mustache, Dallas Cowboys hat on, this tanned, leathery skins, jeans, t-shirt, tennis shoes. He's got his Marlboros in the pocket of his t-shirt. He's drinking Busch out of this tall, silver can. And we just start talking, and he starts telling me about his life. And before I know it, I'm kind of getting the whole story. He starts to unload on me about all the different things that he's experienced over many, many years. And so we talk for maybe 30, 40 minutes. And then when he leaves, he walks around the corner. And right when he leaves, I pick up my phone and I start talking into my phone because I don't want to lose his diction. I'm trying to record what he sounded like because it was unique, this guy, you know. And so I'm talking into my phone, and a few days later when I get back to Kansas, I go and write down the story, some of the story that he told me. Here's what he said. When I was 18, I was on an aircraft carrier. Saw the other side of the world on that thing. In the Navy, yeah, I worked on airplanes. Nah, just missed Vietnam. Then I came home, and I'll be honest with you, Isaac, I've made some mistakes in my life. Went to prison for a DUI, was locked up 5 years. I used to close this bar down, playing pool, chasing the girls, but it's not worth it, I'm telling you. Now I just have a couple beers and I'm done. That was my son who left here a minute ago. I'm trying to teach him the same. The other day he had this big bubble in one of his tires, and he was still driving with it, you know? And I said to him, hell no. Hell no. There's no way you're going to have a blowout on my highway. Because that's how you kill yourself, you know? But he didn't have the cash for a new tire, so I gave it to him, $97. You know what, though? I made him change that tire himself. Taught him how to do it. I said, you go over and get that tire out of my trunk. That's where he's headed now. I showed him how to torque it down. And I said, listen, I know it's spring break, but you better be up tomorrow at 8 a.m. because we have $97 to work off. He said, Dad, you've done so much for me. But see, I'm going to teach that kid how to be a man. And I hope you'll excuse me, Isaac, but I've got to brag about my son for a minute, if that's okay with you. The boy's an artist, almost 20 years old, and he's had some issues like his father. You know, he's still finishing up high school, but last year he drew this picture, drew it by himself, no help from me, a picture of this man being buried alive and one hand reaching up out of the dirt like this, reaching up to be rescued. Didn't help him with it or nothing, and that picture went to state, picked out of the whole school, man. And see, I'm self-employed, an electrician, a plumber, a carpenter. I did the install on those cold boxes in the bar a few years back. I work, what's the word, sporadically. But that kid is my real work, you understand? He's got a gift. I had to sue for custody when his mother and I divorced. Rough times, that's when I got this scar on my cheek, this big one here. He was a baby, just 1 and a half, and his mother and I went to court. And let me tell you something. It wasn't the state of Texas awarded me custody of my son. And it wasn't Judge Herrero either. You know who it was? It was the good Lord gave me that boy. I needed something to keep me going. I needed to learn what life is about, you know, sacrifice and all. It was the good Lord gave me that boy. And if that's how just a dude down in Texas can feel about his son, how much more so does God think about and care for us? Let us give thanks to the Lord for his mercies and the wonders he does for his children. Amen. God, we come before you this evening to recognize this beautiful reality of who you are, your faithfulness, the long arc of your fidelity to people like us, though we don't deserve it, though we often discount it, turn our backs on it, grow numb to it. And we make ourselves available again tonight to the best of our ability to make this move toward praise, because you are worthy of our praise. You are worthy of our gratitude. Would you help us to have faith to continue to make this move over the course of the next many days? Thank you for being a God who gathers people like us to yourself. We pray these things together. Amen. For I received from the Lord what I also passed on to you, Paul writes. The Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me. For whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." You know, I was thinking about the cross and how in many ways it's a symbol of this very reality that we're talking about, a God who gathers people to himself from the east, west, north, south. East, west, north, south, right? That's part of what the cross is meant to symbolize. And so I just want to invite you as we prepare to take communion to consider for yourself the ways God has been faithful to you over the last many months. Sound good? Let's come to the table. In the same way that the psalmist was praying for you and I, Paul is praying for us in Ephesians chapter 3, praying for the church. Receive this benediction. "For this reason I kneel before the Father, from whom every family in heaven and on earth derives its name. I pray that out of his glorious riches, he may strengthen you with power through his Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith. And I pray that you, being rooted and established in love, may have the power, together with all the Lord's people, to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ, and to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God." Go in the name of the one whose commitment to us is forever. Amen. Let's join hands and sing.